This is the IBJ podcast for the week of February 14th, 2022, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Loyal readers of the IBJ know that we've been tracking the slow motion decline of Circle Center Mall in downtown Indianapolis for more than a decade. Nordstrom, one of the original anchor tenants, left in 2011. The Carson Peary Scott department store left in 2018, and smaller tenants have been exiting all the while. On February 4th, we finally received some definitive news about long percolating plans for the property's future. The owners of the mall, a group of more than a dozen companies that joined forces in the early 1990s to help provide financial backing for the mall project, have asked five design groups to submit ideas for reimagining the million-square-foot campus, and they're looking to partner with a developer for what likely will be a massive revamp. It probably will include some residential development, but the sky's the limit. It could include office, entertainment, hotel, and/or public space, not to mention perhaps redesigned retail space. We also learned that Indianapolis-based retail giant Simon Property Group, which was the developer of Circle Center, recently sold its share of the mall. Simon was one of the dozen-plus companies in the original ownership group. That group, called Circle Center Development Company, has absorbed Simon's stake. Now that brings us to Stephen Goldsmith, the two-term mayor of Indianapolis from 1992 to the year 2000. He was instrumental in getting the Circle Center project over the goal line and open to the public in 1995. So we wanted to get his take on this turn of events, this pending transformation of the mall, and what he thinks could work. Now, there's also the question of what this reboot means for the mall's legacy as a major drawing card for downtown. That's part one of today's podcast. As it happens, Goldsmith also has a lot to say about a persistent issue that's been dogging the state of Indiana for years, workforce development. Goldsmith is now a professor of urban policy at Harvard University, and he has co-authored an upcoming book, Growing Fairly: How to Build Opportunity and Equity in Workforce Development. It looks specifically at how to provide opportunities to Americans who are out of work, or are underemployed, or who otherwise face systemic barriers to employment. In the second half of today's podcast, we'll talk about what he's learned from studying not-for-profits and city and state governments that are successfully producing upward mobility. And that includes a fascinating project here in Indianapolis. But first, here's our conversation about Circle Center. I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast Stephen Goldsmith, former two-term mayor of Indianapolis and now a Harvard professor of urban affairs. Thank you so much for making time today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good to be with you. Thank you.
So let's jump right into our first topic, Circle Center Mall. We know that Simon Property Group has left the ownership group for the mall, and the remaining owners and the city and Develop Indy are exploring redevelopment scenarios. 27 years into the life of the mall, is this at all surprising to you?
Well, what's surprising is it's been so successful for so long, not that it needs rejuvenation now. I mean, we never really envisioned a quarter of a century as its life cycle, even had we known what we know today about retail, right? We just wouldn't have anticipated the length of it. And at the time that we decided to go forward, which is difficult in and of itself, there weren't even then very many successful downtown malls. So it doesn't surprise me. I'm very pleased to hear about it. And also pleased it had a good long run.
So when it opened in 95, was there an expectation that it would stay more or less the same, like a LS Ayers department store did for so long? Or did you assume that something else would need to happen at some point?
Well, let's back up a little bit and think about the mall, not just as a mall. The goal back then was to kickstart downtown Indianapolis. I mean, as I joke occasionally, we had two retailers. We had a wig shop in St. Elmo's, and that was about it at the time, right? It was just nothing there. And we wanted to create an experience. We wanted to create a place where people could live, where they would enjoy working, right? We just relocated. We're in the process of relocating more headquarters into downtown Indianapolis and for convention and visitors, right? We needed some peace. So I just mentioned it that way because we anticipated that downtown Indy would always need a catalytic event. It may be a performance arena. It may be a new headquarters like Indianapolis is getting on the old GM site. It may be a mall. So we didn't have an expectation of the life expectancy of the mall, but we did have an expectation that Indianapolis would constantly need a new Big Bang, right? A new attraction, because it depended on bringing people from the region and from outside the region into the city. So, but I would say, honestly, 27 years is longer than I expected. And particularly since it had such a financially successful run of it in that quarter century.
Yeah, I think that the temptation from afar is to say, well, look, you know, the mall failed, although it's been open for 26 years. How specifically would you say it was a success for Indianapolis as a downtown shopping mall? How did it contribute to the success of downtown?
Well, let me take your question apart in two ways. First, I think the fact that the city, the state, Simon and the equity partners that we put together at the time have decided they need to do something different with the mall represents a really nice step for the future and doesn't necessarily represent an indictment to the past. I don't take it as critical in the least. I say it's successful because the number of visitors that came through there, you know, we went from a handful of downtown visitors to at one time over 20 million a year. We went from a handful of downtown hospitality workers to over 50,000 a year, not just because of the mall, but because of all the things that downtown Indy and Visit Indy have done. Indianapolis's stature, as you can see from the NCAA and Super Bowl and other activities, football finals, all produce a success for the city. So I'd say the mall is a success because it's financially has been a success for the partners and because it helps stimulate that response. It's not going to continue to be a valuable part of that story without reimagining what it should be. So that's why I say it was successful, even though obviously now it's not successful as a retail center, which is congratulations for the equity partners buying out the Simons to take the step forward.
Would you be surprised to eventually see those partners also cash out once a strategy for the mall is set and a developer is found?
I don't know. I'm not that close to it, but we should, those of us who care a lot about Indianapolis, just say thanks to those equity partners. I mean, that mall was virtually impossible to put together financially. It took European debt and U.S. and Indianapolis companies to put in equity. That equity produced enough value that they could also help me put together the what then was called Conseco Fieldhouse. I don't know how long they intend to stay, but they've stayed for 27 years. And but for them, there would not be a mall, right? So whatever they want to do, I'm all for them.
Right on. So you're a professor of urban affairs. What are you seeing in other cities in terms of redevelopment of properties like this?
Well, the downtown mall shopping issue is a problem everywhere from New York to Chicago to, you know, to failed malls in the past. You know, the Columbus Mall that preceded Indianapolis and closed very shortly after it opened is offices now. So it's a range of things. I hope for the future. I was involved with the Washington Nationals and the Anacostia redevelopment in Washington, D.C., and I'm hopeful that the city's vision and the owners of the mall is for the reuse of the property, but the catalytic effect on the neighborhood, right? So what else will it cause to happen? And so what we're seeing is kind of reuse around the country, but a reuse that's not retail heavy. It might have a little entertainment value, might have a little residential value, as you know, at least pre-COVID, and still continuing. Downtowns, including Indianapolis, have become much hotter places for young professionals to live. So whatever kind of complements that experience, as well as the convention. I mean, people need to have a place to go when they come to Indianapolis conventions, and all those hotels are connected to the mall. So there needs to be something in the mall they want to go to.
I mean, my experience with the mall, I mean, consistently has been about the food court. And I have the sense, especially when there are large events in town, that it is a very valuable asset for large convention groups. For example, when the Gen Con folks come, it's like, you know, the train station in London. I mean, it has a very important use. Does it need to maintain some kind of use for gathering and perhaps feeding people.
Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, I don't want to present myself as the expert on this, which of course I'm not. At the time, we had a lot of expert advice from around the country, and that advice produced a number of ideas, which we were able to synthesize in the mall. And I hope that the way everyone's going about it now will produce terrific ideas from around the country, from people who really know what they're doing. And the role of the ownership team now and the city and state, which will have to help, right, will be to support the ideas. And let me just kind of close by saying the following, right? Well, let's step back to where I was in the early 90s. Why do we care, right? Let's kind of close with that concept. Well, we care for a number of really important reasons, and not just as a city, as a region. We care because the downtown of Indianapolis is the regional symbol, right? It's how people think about the region and its success. We care because over 50,000, some people say 70,000 hospitality jobs depend on the success of the Indianapolis convention hospitality business. We care because that convention hospitality business needs to offer places for folks to go even in the winter where they can't walk outside, right? So that there has to be enough activities for that. And we care, and this is the reason the city and state should put money into this transaction, because it generates, that whole hospitality business, including the mall, generates a lot of revenue for the city and state. Sales taxes, food taxes, hotel taxes, taxes that are not paid by Indianapolis residents. This is a really big deal. So for all those reasons, getting this right is quite important.
I don't know how much you get back to Indianapolis, but is there something that you particularly would like to see there or something you think would best enhance downtown?
I think I'll pass on that. I would hope that it combines a set of uses that furthers the goals I just mentioned a minute ago. And I kind of feel like I would know it when I see it, but I'd like to see it, right? So when we did the Anacostia and Washington National Stadium after Indianapolis, the number of invigorating ideas that came in was terrific. And I'm hoping that Indianapolis's reputation will allow us to kind of punch above our size. I mean, the same sort of can-do spirit that brought the entire NCAA tournament to Indianapolis should be invested in the mall. We can be something more than folks expect us to be, and let's prove it with the next redesign of the mall.
I mean, it's a fairly large property. Would you be surprised if they actually were to tear down some of it and try to create something new?
Yeah, some parts of it are historic, and that would be difficult, and other parts of it aren't historic. The footings and support system don't allow it to go up very high without kind of restructuring it. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is a, not just a reconfiguration, but a rebuilding of part of it. And then, and just like at the time, the city and state will need to support the infrastructure side of it and the parking side of it. So yeah, I would not be surprised if it has some restructuring of the property itself.
Yeah, as I recall, I think there were, I think, 9 historic facades that you were able to save. And the mall, I think at least on the northern side, is built into historic some buildings. It's integrated into at least the old Ellis Ayers building.
The northern side, almost the entire northern side, is made up of historic buildings.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. Here's part 2 of our discussion with former Indianapolis Mayor Stephen Goldsmith.
So for the second half of our interview with Stephen Goldsmith, I wanted to take this opportunity to talk about your upcoming book, which you've co-authored with Kate Markin Coleman. It's called Growing Fairly, How to Build Opportunity and Equity in Workforce Development. I think, as I said before we started the interview, I would be tempted to say, due to how much we discuss this issue at every IBJ public event that covers every major industry, workforce development is the most important economic issue for employers in Indiana. Employers need workers who are adequately trained for specialized jobs that are rapidly evolving. If you can't find qualified employees, you can't grow. And I see that your book looks specifically at how to provide opportunities to Americans who are out of work or are underemployed or otherwise face systemic barriers to employment. So what is the current approach to workforce development, and why is it not working?
Well, it's a little harsh to say it's not working. Let's just say it's not working sufficiently. I think we should pay attention to the fact that the labor market forces have dramatically changed, right? When I, you know, in the old days when I was in Indianapolis, let's picture it, I could go out to the GM stamping plant or the Ford assembly plant or the Chrysler foundry or fill in the blank, and I'd see a lot of workers earning a good middle-class wage who had been there for a very long period of time. So their mobility ladders were managed in those businesses, right? It's not just that those businesses are gone, that the concept that you would join a company and you would move up through the ranks and through tenure, you would achieve a decent living wage. This just doesn't happen very much. People move around or they get let off or the businesses go out of business. Secondly, the nationally, and to some extent in Indianapolis, the difficulty, the density of poverty in certain neighborhoods is so overwhelming that it actually restricts the opportunities of individuals growing up there. It restricts their brain development, it restricts their access to transit, it restricts their social network to folks who maybe not have jobs. So those folks face really substantial hurdles. And then I think if you put those two things together, you can see that a region like Indianapolis needs to be coordinated as a system. So my short answer, now that I've given the long answer, is that the pieces are often present, but they need coordination. They need an intermediary who manages the coordination. They need to be based on real-time data. There's now so much more data available other than what the old workforce approach, which is use a Bureau of Labor Statistics data, which is a little clumsy. So we need a new way of doing it. It needs to be better organized. It needs to be sharpened up. It needs to provide training skills. It needs to help understand that the array of services that people need to get to work, right, is the skilling job. It's upskilling, but it's also transit and childcare and the executive education's executive skills that people need to figure out how to operate in the workplace. Those pieces need to come together, and that's the theme of the book.
I think one of the tenets of the book, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that diversity, equity, and inclusion are vital to workforce development. And then, and way in the distance, I hear some people rolling their eyes in the back of their head saying, why does this always have to be about diversity? Sure. Explain why.
Well, there's a couple reasons it's about diversity. One, it's the current system is unfair, but let's start with that. Secondly, if Indianapolis is going to continue as a productive region, it needs labor, which is why it comes up in all of the IBJ discussions. And there's no better way to produce the labor needed in a community than to give opportunity to those who are not currently working or to upskill them. So think about recreating the missing rungs on the ladder, right? That's been growing fairly, that's what we talk about. It's kind of where those rungs come from. Well, they come from upskilling, right? So as people upskill, they become more productive and they fill the jobs that are now open. And as they upskill, they open the jobs of where they were, right? So how can we do that? We did there's a chapter in the book we did with a United Negro College Fund and the mayor of Atlanta and a data company called Burning Glass MZ. And it examined the jobs in the Atlanta region, and folks of color were underrepresented predictably in the middle and higher ranks and overly represented in the lower ranks. Well, let's just think about this. In part is equity, but let's just also think about it in terms of it's in the enlightened self-interest of everyone in the region, whether you're in Carmel or Greenwood or wherever you might live or downtown Indianapolis, to create more productivity, and that creates more fairness. So these things come together, I think, in a very nice way.
What are the general principles for making a better workforce development system? How would you lay that out?
We have 10 principles in the book, and I won't bore you with all 10 principles. We spent 2 years going around the country, some virtually and some in person before COVID, kind of interviewing nonprofits and city officials and workforce officials and lots of individuals. Some of the work and stories in the book come from folks who are programs who are affiliated with Strata, which is a locally Indianapolis foundation. And so I would say, let me focus on the good news, right? Indianapolis is a pretty good place, right? The Goodwill XL centers in Indianapolis are quite remarkable places. The Cook Medical investment with Goodwill on the Near East Side, it's really dramatic. I mean, that's just a really, of all the things we saw, that's one that people should really brag about. That's very impressive. And Ascend Indiana, Ascend is a pretty impressive organization by national standards. And it's, I would say that it supported apprentice program for, right? One of the things we saw as we went around is that individuals in high school, let's not assume that everyone's going to have a four-year college degree. That's just not a good assumption. And it has its own set of kind of racial issues, because if the path to a good job is only a college degree, then it's going to be by definition to have a disproportionate racial impact. So let's think about how to get people into living wage jobs. Well, we found that young adults, we interviewed Hispanic students in Houston, for example, they need to believe that this is a opportunity for them, that they can earn a good wage and it's a respectable job. And so you have to start in high school to create the pathways, if you will, into good jobs, which is what, you know, Ascend is doing and IPS and others and local businesses with this project in Indianapolis. So you need to use real-time data. What are the skills needed in Indianapolis over the next 10 years? Not what are the degrees needed, but what are the skills needed, right? Who is offering those skills, Ivy Tech or who is offering those specific skills? Back in the old days, when I was mayor, like the really old days, we touched on this actually. I got frustrated that Ivy Tech was not offering 16-week courses for expert tool and die workers, right? We had more open jobs and not enough tool and die workers. Well, how do you do it? Well, you don't go tell a number of folks that need to get degrees. You offer the entry-level pathway to the tool and die jobs, right? So Ivy Tech, we paid Ivy Tech to offer these 16. So what are those skill sets? What do they look like, the shapes of those skills? What are they going to be in the future for Indianapolis to be successful? Who's offering that training? How do we communicate that training? And then lastly, the book also deals with kind of the obvious thing that, you know, United Way and others in Indianapolis are paying attention to, which is how do you organize the wraparound services? And it's not easy, right? In fact, you can't tell a mom who's really busy with her children, who doesn't have very good bus service, doesn't have very good childcare services, doesn't have a lot of networking in the business community, you know, there's a piece over here, there's a piece over here, there's a piece over here. You put them together. That's just not life, right? So we need to help folks with organizing the wraparound services, the executive skills, the upskilling, and then make sure it works together as a region. So those are some of the principles in the book.
You brought up the Cook Medical Project. And I was going to bring that up separately myself. So just for folks who aren't familiar with it, Cook Medical, which is based in Bloomington, is building a 40,000 square foot manufacturing plant on the east side, East 38th Street in Sheridan. It's only using diverse contractors to build the plant. It intends to hire 100 people from the neighborhood as employees. It's providing the training itself. This really strikes me as a program that is driven explicitly by the employer. To the degree it works, it will be because the employer wanted it to happen. What is the role of employers in your book, and how closely do they need to be involved?
Well, in the workforce development over the last 30 years, government officials have designed programs and forgot that the programs they're designing are actually for business, right? So these things have to be in large part driven by the needs and configuration of business. Business needs to be a little bit more creative and how they kind of reach out to labor, but the demands of what they need to be business. Now, we say in the book that one of the principles that business should observe is they need to hire on the basis of skills, not just degrees. So there is not a you know, perfect business answer. But if the businesses are creative with respect to their pipelines and onboarding, and I think one of the things that's interesting about the Cook project is their partner is Goodwill. So Goodwill has a lot of really, particularly Indianapolis Goodwill, which is known as one of the best in the country, has a lot of experience taking challenged workers and providing productive jobs in a way that helped the employer and the worker. So creativity, I mean, this Cook Medical thing with Goodwill, I mean, it's really one of the best in the country. People should you know, I don't know what, they should plant a ribbon on the side of the building in both Bloomington and Indianapolis when they go by and just say thank you. I think it's, I hope it works. It's really impressive the way it's configured.
Is that featured in the book?
Yes.
Let's say that you get tired of academia, you become a politician again, and you're running a mid-sized city. Which one of these would you want to implement or pursue as quickly as possible?
Well, I think one practical answer to your question is the following. Indianapolis and every other city in America has a huge amount of money to spend now on infrastructure. It may have more, but it has a lot of money now. It doesn't have a huge number of construction workers. It just has a huge amount of money for construction. And I would say this is a chance to have broadly scalable apprentice programs where we recruit people in high school. We train them with, you know, in one of the places we talked about in the book, they created the electrical employers actually created the classrooms in the school so they look like work sites. They wouldn't look like classrooms, right? They brought in people from the company, electricians from the company to help with the teaching, right? It was very relevant. They got jobs in the electrical contractor, so they were making money at the time and they could see the future, right? They learned math, but they learned math in school in a way that was relevant to the electrical engineering. So they saw the relevancy in the contextualization of the skills they need. All right, so if you scale up the apprentice programs, you also need to scale up the support services and organize them around families that need the assistance. And that includes, there's grant programs now available to the city for transportation. South Bend did a really interesting project where it did kind of subsidized Uber rides for folks where the buses, you know, just couldn't get the workers there in time. Because just one of our aspirations in the book is to get folks who are doing well to stand back and understand the challenges of life for those who aren't. It's not just that, why don't you guys wake up and go to work one day? That's not feasible. You can't get to work. The transit is bad. The childcare is unavailable. You don't have social networks that say, you know, look, Jimmy, I'm going to talk to Joe, who I work with, and go see him, and he'll tell you a little bit how to get a job, right? You know, the things that a lot of us do. So all of that needs to come together. I would focus on apprentice programs and the construction dollars and apprentice programs and the IT jobs. Right, there's some very sophisticated manufacturing jobs available in Indianapolis. That's quite cool. I would focus on all those things and create a better pipeline.
Are you going to come back to promote the book?
Yeah, I'm going to come back. I don't want to promote the ideas in the book. Right? I don't make much money in the book. I just write a lot of books that nobody reads. But I think this book may be relevant, and I'm hoping to have probably in April, late March and April, a few discussions with Indianapolis thought leaders on the book.
Well, that'd be great. I hope we're there. Thank you so much for making time today. This has been fantastic.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My thanks again to Stephen Goldsmith. His new book, Growing Fairly, How to Build Opportunity and Equity in Workforce Development, will officially be released on February 22nd and will be available from your major booksellers. And you can read more about the latest developments with Circle Center in a story by Mickey Shuey on the front page of the latest edition of IBJ. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few other stories in the latest print edition of IBJ I want to point out. First up, Eli Lilly and Company has high hopes for donanemab, its new experimental drug for Alzheimer's disease, and a potential blockbuster for the pharma giant. But John Russell reports that its prospects have dimmed recently, with a draft policy from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that would restrict reimbursement payments for the drug. Also in this week's paper, Emily Ketterer reports that Indiana lawmakers are working to set up the first regulatory framework for utilities to build charging stations for electric vehicles. And Dave Lindquist fleshes out the plan for High and Mighty Craft Distillery to open at the Indiana State Fairgrounds as its first year-round retail tenant in two decades. Again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. Now that's a little easier said than done, but I can guarantee you access if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for all of the latest news about local business and politics, plus all of IBJ's data about the central Indiana economy and corporate community. Just go to ibj.com, click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.